Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:33 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is February 28th, last day of the month, and I thought that today I would focus more on individual shares and the price action that we're seeing. So Nestlé today caught my attention because it's closing below the 1,000-day moving average. Now, that doesn't happen very often. In fact, every single time it has done that in the last decade, it has been a beautiful buying opportunity. So it does beg the question that is this another buying opportunity, considering that the most recent occasion was back in November, and since then it's encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions. So the last time we had something like that was back in 2018. It dipped below the 1,000-day moving average, rebounded to the 200-day moving average. Then, if we just zoom right in here, what we can very clearly see is that, and I don't know why that's not working, we can see that there was an upside key reversal and then upside follow-through right in the middle of June of 2018. So not only did it come down to the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but it got a beautiful bottoming signal at the same time. So then let's just zoom out and look at more back history, because Nestlé is the kind of company that doesn't tend to stay down for very long. It's a company that has very reliable cash flows, and it's got dominant positions in several business lines like bottled water and coffee and chocolate and pet food for that matter. But there's absolutely no doubt that today the price is a bit above 100, and 3 years ago it was also a bit above 100. So there's been a very significant loss of of momentum and uptrend consistency, considering that this range has dipped back into the underlying range. Although I would also highlight that that's not especially unusual. So the most significant trend consistency is the tendency to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And we're going to find out pretty soon whether this is a buying opportunity or whether it is a break of a trend. And then what is it that could possibly be breaking the trend? Well, I think the most important is the yield. The dividend yield right now is about 2.75. Now, if we then look at that, I think it's that if we can graph those fundamentals, well, what we're then presented with is going to be something a little bit different here. Let's just look at, instead of looking at market cap, let's look at that dividend yield. So we've seen on occasion that the yield has got up to about 3.5%, and it's been quite a while since it's been around 3%. But back when it bounced in 2019, 2018, it was at 3%. And over the course of the preceding decade, every time the yield popped on the upside, it was bought. So it was viewed as a hedge. But unfortunately, yields right now are quite a bit higher in the bond market than they are for a quality company like Nestlé. So that is creating competition. And therefore, the logical conclusion is that the valuation will have to contract. So the PE, or at least the historic PE, is 31, and the estimated PE is 21. But that's assuming, of course, that earnings don't roll over. Now, Nestlé is raising prices, and companies tend to do well in a new inflationary environment when at the very beginning, because they get their pricing power back. And that lasts for quite a while. But then consumers become wise to it and they start consuming less. And therefore, what we've generally seen historically is that companies do well in the early stages of an inflationary trend and then don't do well in the latter half. And that's why some people view stocks as one of the better hedges against inflation, whereas others would question it. And but of course, the reality is that it's not about whether they're a good or a bad hedge. It's really more that companies tend to be the best form of hedge in the early stages of an inflationary trend, and a less effective hedge towards the end. In other words, you get an inflationary boom and then you get an inflationary bust. Now, let's look at Johnson and Johnson. So, a big pharmaceutical company, but also a big consumer products company. And the share is now also back below the 1,000-day moving average. Now, this hasn't been the most consistent of trends. It has certainly gone up. And we've had several big ranges, and each of them have dipped down into the preceding range. But the hallmark of the trend overall has been the tendency to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It broke below it last week. It's extending the decline in here this week. And again, if we zoom out and look at the longer-term trend, well, we have a very consistent pattern of trending higher since 2012. And then for much of the decade before that, well, then the price didn't really go anywhere between about 2002 and 2012. So again, this is another way of thinking about it in terms of that dividend yield. And perhaps just to speed things up, what I'll do is I'll just create a separate window here. But we can definitely see that when it gets up to that magic 3.5% level, people buy it. But we haven't been above 3.5% or even 3% at any point in much of the last decade. So we're definitely at an interesting level here for some of these companies. Now, one might argue that Pfizer is pulling back because the pandemic is over and because they've just announced that they're going to go off and buy Seagen. But there's no denying that it is back below that 1,000-day moving average, and it hasn't tended to do that all that often, at least since 2011. So we certainly had a lot of back and forth action in 2020, and then the subsequent acceleration. And that was a massive breakout from a well-defined range, and now we're seeing it unwinding. So obviously this is a rather different environment. Now, let's also look at that dividend yield. And we can see that yields back in 2009 were very high. But then, subsequent to that, it was a buying opportunity around 5%, and we're currently closer to 4%. Now, it's not every stock has broken lower, but certainly some have had toppy activity, and Costco is one of those. So we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and we have a period of right-hand extension with a sequence of lower rally highs, and the share continues to drop. Now, it's not a dividend aristocrat, but Costco does have a solid history of paying dividends, and then it tends to have special cash dividends. And that's one of the things that generally would disqualify any company from being a dividend aristocrat, because dividend aristocrats reward reliability, and volatility, whether up or down, is generally tends to disqualify companies. Having said, I would open a separate window. I didn't actually continue using it. I do apologize for that. So when we then look at Costco's dividend, it's really choppy because of those outsized payments. But at the moment, we're at 0.75%. And let's just put this into perspective, just from an annual yield perspective. The 12-month yield on the US Treasury market is testing 5%. So one would have to get a lot of capital appreciation to compensate one for the risk we're taking in buying a stock like Costco, when it only yields 3/4 of a percent or 0.8 of a percent, and the 12-month treasury yields at 5%. So this is obviously something that is shading the way that investors look at the market. Now, we can then think about companies like McDonald's or Coca-Cola or Pepsi, where McDonald's is still above its 200-day moving average, and Coca-Cola is coming back down again, but it is still above the 1,000-day moving average, which has historically offered support. Pepsi is another example. So Pepsi is looking less consistent. We've had a significant loss of momentum. We still have the sequence of higher reaction lows, but we have a succession of failed upside breaks, and now it is pulling back again. This has the characteristics of a clear type 2 top formation right before we get a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. So that's really not bullish. And then the yield is only about 2.6. And when we think about the valuation, it's still north of 20. So we've been conditioned to expect that commonplace shares should have high valuations. But those high valuations were justifiable in a very low interest rate environment. And that's just not justifiable in here right now. Now, of course, all of these companies are big consumer companies, and we still have record low unemployment in several countries. So one would anticipate then that because they're consumer-oriented companies, they should be doing well. But we've definitely had some loss of momentum. And the Dividend Aristocrats ETF is hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average. So I think that there's certainly the potential here that we're going to get at least some additional weakness coming through. And that would help to improve the yield, reduce the valuation, and make some of these stocks more attractive against a background where the comparative rate is rising because of interest rates. So it's very easy to think about what's happening right now in terms of inflation, in that what we're really getting is an inflationary boom. Inflationary figures are still high, the unemployment rate is low. There are lots of available jobs, at least posted jobs, and most of the layoffs have been focused within the better paid white collar sector, certainly not those that are represented by unions. So the knock-on effects have yet to be experienced. And then what we are definitely seeing is that interest rates are rising. The size of central bank balance sheets are contracting, and money supply growth is negative for the first time. We have inverted yield curves, and the speed with which interest rates have gone up has been exceptionally quick. So therefore, it's reasonable to anticipate that eventually that tighter liquidity condition is going to catch up with the market. Now let's perhaps look at some of the constituents of the Nasdaq. None, these are not generally considered to be dividend-paying stocks, and some of them don't pay dividends at all, but they have tended to be very cash generative. So Amazon, it has been trending downwards since the beginning of, or really the end of 2021, and has encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions, and it's miles below the 1,000-day moving average. Then Meta was one of the bigger performers in here today in early trading, and it has rebounded very impressively from the lows at the end of last year up to the peak. It more than doubled. Now we're getting a little bit of pause and consolidation. And it was in positive territory today, but not in an especially dynamic manner. Then let's pay attention to Apple. So Apple is developing its own advertising business, and I think that is where the majority of the growth is likely to come from, less because of a new big profit product offering, and perhaps more because they want to leverage their subscriber base. So by using the App Store as a walled garden, then what they're really doing is creating a captured client base that they will then sell access to. And that is certainly going to be one of their major profit centers. It doesn't mean they can't make money from it. Of course they can. But are we going to see the same kind of outsized new product growth market when that's when I think one of the most promising products that they have is that they would have a non-invasive glucose monitor on the Apple Watch, but that could be years away. Then I think it's particularly interesting that Tesla is still holding on here in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, the share is still above the $200 area, and it's really quite overbought. So I think there is clear potential that it's going to unwind some of this overbought condition. There was an agreement today that Tesla would build a battery factory in northern Mexico, and there has been very little focus on the recall that was announced last week because of malfunctions in their self-driving technology. What I found particularly interesting, however, is that Tesla is now looking at forming joint ventures on artificial intelligence. But a lot of the valuation that was attached to the company was based upon the assumption that because they had so many sensors in their cars, that they were picking up all of this additional data that they would then be able to feed into their AI system and come up with self-driving technology faster than anyone else. Well, if they are now bringing in outside help to try and create an artificial intelligence system, that would really raise some important questions about just how successful they've been in developing their own in-house artificial intelligence. I think this is really quite an important point that hasn't been fully explored by the markets yet. And then Tesla are also leaking pictures of a hatchback version, which could retail for $25,000 and make it a real mass market vehicle. But these are pictures on a drawing board rather than products on the street. And I do think that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on right now. Then let's just pay attention to what's happening in some of these commodities, because copper prices rebounded in here today and popped back above the $4 level. So that's the upper side of the underlying range, and it's beginning to demonstrate that support is coming back in at a place which is necessary for the consistency of the trend to remain intact. I continue to be of the view that the uranium sector will do better from here, and the Global X uranium ETF is also in an area of potential support. Oil prices, having got right down to the lower side of the range, have bounced, and the Brent crude price was up in excess of a dollar in here today. So the sequence of higher reaction lows continues to hold, and that's true over the last 3 months. Then we also have a sequence of lower rally highs that's been in evidence since March of last year, and we've seen several occasions on which the price has encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. So now the big question is, are we going to see it pop up and through that 200-day moving average? Because we've had this very inert period, then I think it is reasonable to anticipate that when oil does move, then it is going to do so in an aggressive manner. So now let's look at what does the backwardation chart look like. Now this is the difference. This is a 6 month backwardation chart, so not the spread between the first month and the second month. And we can see that there was a wide backwardation in early 2022. Then it became it turned into a contango, and now we're starting to see the backwardation rise once more. When we just look at the absolute contract table, we can also then graphically see that we have a backwardation between April, May to June, and then onwards. And that is extending pretty clearly. So let's see if we can find the chart between the first and second months. Because one thing that is clear is when you see a change in the direction of the spread, that generally coincides with a change in the trend. So the fact now that Brent has gone from being in a big backwardation in 2022 to a dollar plus contango at the end of 2022 and now back into backwardation, that raises the possibility that when the breakout comes, it's going to be on the upside. And that is also going to contribute to inflationary pressures, because I've already started to hear people complaining about how much the price of gasoline has gone up again. And the S&P 500 Energy Index is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. And then we also have natural gas prices, which, having really contracted very violently, are now beginning to improve again. So 5 days on the upside, reversing an intraday decline in here today. So natural gas has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and this is looking like a dynamic move, particularly when we zoom out and look at it on a weekly basis. So there's obviously been a lot of selling pressure, and now we're getting a good sized rebound. So I'm beginning to think about whether I should just increase my position. But I do think that there is clear potential for at least an unwinding of the overextension relative to the 1,000-day moving average, which would be at least a double in the price. I saw an article today where restaurants in Los Angeles are complaining about what their gas bills are, because with the closing down of regional gas fields in the Los Angeles Valley, California has been reliant on imports from elsewhere, and there just isn't enough pipeline capacity to bring in the gas that California requires. But the thing that I noticed when I moved to Texas was that when you go to a steak restaurant here, and more often than not, that steak will arrive on a bed of risotto. Now, risotto is virtually unheard of in Los Angeles, and that's because it takes forever to make. You've got to stand over a pot and you've got to stir until the rice softens. And you've got to continually add ingredients into it. So not only is it difficult to pay somebody enough to compensate them to actually make it, but then obviously you have to have the gas on underneath it all the time. So the kinds of dishes that take 6 or 7 or 10 or 12 or 16 or 24 hours to marinate and make, or slow boil for really rich soups, or broths for making noodles, That's just impossible when natural gas prices jump. Now, that's something that California is dealing with at present. And we're not going to see it. That's obviously not something that everywhere else is dealing with, but it is a taste of what happens when there isn't any money put into infrastructure and when you allow politics to get in the way of the reality of dealing with life. So I think these are important lessons. Now, I don't think it's going to result in any kind of electoral change in California, but it is certainly something that everyone else needs to think about, that if we're going to have a carbon zero mandate in lots of different areas, well, then people need to start thinking about what reality of life includes rather than idealism. Idealism, and I think this is perhaps one of the most greatest insights, is that Marx himself said that all idealism is false. But that includes his own, and it certainly includes the utopian ideals of the carbon zero minority. But then let's also think about the fact that in order to achieve their goals, they've created carbon credits, and the carbon credit market is pushing up through the 100 euro level. It's the stated objective to get carbon credits up to 130 euro to support the nascent hydrogen economy. And therefore, we can anticipate that the next stop for carbon credit prices will probably be somewhere around 130. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.